No, the brothers. Or as I insist on calling them, the Karamazov brothers. The flying Karamazov brothers.
Verkhovensky?
Yes.
Sorry, I'm having a
little fun here.
Is this what you were trying to say? Is this what you're trying to pronounce? Yeah, the accent is here. It's Vyazvolodovich. Vyazvolodovich.
I think it's can make the V almost silent.
You can. It's actually an F. It's a Vyazvolodovich.
Okay, thank you.
The V is, the V sound is actually a preposition in Russian, but we don't have to get into that. All right, I'm going to pick up a little bit where we left off. You know, we left off last time with the whole business of Kirillov and the idea that if man takes the power to kill himself, then he is God. That if everybody recognizes that he has this power, then there is no God. And of course, that means that what we do is speak of human will as being the greatest power in the universe. And we could, I suppose, speak of certain 19th century thinkers who wrote on the whole question of will and power. So this Kirillov is not unique in this respect. Anybody know, in fact, a very prominent 19th century German philosopher writer who spoke of will before Nietzsche?
Schopenhauer,
yeah. The whole question of will comes to the fore there. Well, Kirillov, then, is in effect a man who wants to be a kind of mock Christ, if you think about it. And as a matter of fact, there's something rather good on this. In Edward Vasilek's book on Dostoevsky, in which he points out that the difference, the similarity between Kirillov's view of himself and Christ is that Christ comes to save all of mankind from spiritual death. Kirillov comes to liberate mankind from God. That's his view of himself. But Kirillov is not really a very original thinker. If you bear in mind Schopenhauer and later Nietzsche, but especially Schopenhauer, because Dostoevsky wouldn't have been aware of Nietzsche at this point, not particularly. The will to power, then, is what Kirillov is all about. But Kirillov is not original enough, really, to be a thinker of any consequence. And so what we see in him, I think, is not an antichrist, but a clown Christ, a parody Christ. And this takes us very much into some major thematics. I talked a little bit last time about the apocalyptic imagery in this novel, and it's even more prominent in this novel than it was in The Idiot. And also, I think I said just a little bit about the demonic. There is a book by the British Russian critic, whose name I mentioned last time, Letherborough, who's written a book called A Devil's Vaudeville. And this is, in fact, a phrase lifted right out of The Devils. And I want to explore this whole business of a devil's vaudeville in some more detail later. But today what I thought we would do is look especially at this early section of the novel, especially that section of part one that's called By Way of an Introduction. I want to go through a few salient passages and look at them in some detail. And then if there's time at the end, say a few words about Bakhtin's concept of carnival, again, and also the Feast of Fools, because there seem to be a lot of Feast of Fools. They're in fact called a fête, or feast. And, of course, the theme of the Lord of Misrule. And here the Lord of Misrule is, of course, Piotr Verkhovensky, the son of Stepan Verkhovensky. By the way, in your translation, these are rendered in their English equivalents, so it's Stefan, and it's Peter, and it's Maurice, and it's Nicholas, right? But I'm attached to the Russian original names. And also I noticed the translator refers to Mr. Stavrogin, for example, or Mrs. Stavrogin. You would never do that in Russian, but of course that's what we do in English. So if you're translating it into English idiom, that's what you would do. But that's not terribly important. I just want to clear that up in case you get too confused by my absent-mindedly referring to Nikolai Sivolodovich and not to Stavrogin or Nicholas Stavrogin. All right, to begin with, there is, oh, and one other thing before I forget. I put a chapter of a book by Jonathan Beaker on Victor Considérant, on Blackboard, if you care to look at it. It's a chapter that's sort of useful for Dostoevsky because it has a summary description of Fourier's system to give you an idea of what the new harmony is, and his theory of the passions. And this is directly relevant to this novel, except that, of course, Fourier's theory of the passions exists in this novel in a very bizarre way. By the way, there's also a chapter on Reunion, the colony that Considérant established here in what is now Dallas County. It was on the edge of what then was called Tarrant County, interestingly enough, which encompassed the eastern part of what is now Irving. But if you're interested in that, I gave the call number of the book, and you can look it up. It's not necessarily related to Dostoevsky in any direct way, so I didn't put it on Blackboard. After all, if I put too much stuff on Blackboard, you won't look at it at all. This way, at least maybe one of you, out of curiosity, will get hold of the book in the library and read chapter, whatever it is, 14, I think. All right, now, moving right along. So there are certain characters now who have a kind of comic character about them. And one is certainly Verkhovensky, that is Stepan Verkhovensky. This is not only adumbrated in his drama, poetic drama based on Faust Part II, which is very funny, but which at the same time is directly relevant thematically to the novel as a whole, but also little touches like this on page 34 of your text. This is at the, in the paragraph at the top. The newspapers and journals which Mrs. Stavrogin ordered in great numbers, he read continually. Now, by the way, you have to be struck by something very interesting, and that is the influence of newspapers on fiction in this period, especially on Russian fiction. And the newspaper becomes a resource now for liberal thought. This is why Verkhovensky keeps up with the newspapers. And we'll see in The Brothers a little bit later that many of the examples that Ivan Karamazov takes for his list of horrors in the world all come from newspapers. And by the way, a good number of episodes or anecdotes told in this book came from newspapers. So the newspaper becomes a source that was, you might say in its impact, sort of the equivalent of the internet now. And suddenly there was all of this information that people didn't have before, and it was available, at least relative to those times, instantly. So he reads newspapers, and he keeps up with them. And this is a sure sign of a liberal. All right. He was always interested in the successes of Russian literature, though without losing the sense of his own dignity. So he is, like many Russians, he's very proud of the fact that the Russians are in the midst of developing what it, to all contemporary eyes, may well have seemed the beginnings of a great literature that would stand to, you might say, compete with what was being written in the West. At one time, he was rather interested in home and foreign affairs, but soon gave it up. It also frequently happened that he would take de Tocqueville with him into the garden, while he secretly carried a pole de Kock in his pocket. Still, this is not important. Who's de Tocqueville? The French traveler who came to the United States and wrote a book that is very, very often cited, first of all, by political philosophers, but is extremely well known for its perspicuity in describing the new American nation. America occurs in another place in this novel. Where? Who are they?
Kirillov,
Shatov, and sorry?
No,
it's Pyotr. Yeah, okay. And these three are the radicals who represent the entire span of, you might say, extreme Russian thought. Right, although Pyotr or Peter is another question altogether. We'll get to more about him next time because we have to. I am assuming that you haven't read much beyond page 354 or so, or actually 346, maybe at best 358 or so. And next time, I'm going to assume that you have read to 537, that is up through chapter 3 of part 3.
And that's what the course
okay.
will be over?
That's right.
Yeah. Okay? All right. So now that we've got that settled, let's press on. Who's Paul de Kock? If you know this, I'll be amazed. In James Joyce's Ulysses, anybody ever read or reading James Joyce's Ulysses? Uh-huh. Molly Bloom is reading Paul de Kock in bed. So he was a somewhat racy early 19th century French novelist.
He shows up in a lot of Dostoevsky.
He does, yeah, he does.
He's in Crime and
Punishment. He was, yeah, he was popular, you know, but not very reputable. So he carries de Tocqueville, but he reads Paul de Kock. So America, and now, by the way, Texas was a favorite spot for utopians in this period, and very much associated with advanced thought. By the way, people in San Antonio were, the newspaper was a bit upset about the reunion colony coming up in Dallas County. And you know, they sounded exactly like contemporary Texans. They said, this is a bunch of socialists. They're left wingers. They're going, exactly. It's fascinating seeing how things don't change much in 150 years. All right, so those are the two things he's reading. Now on page 36, we discover that the people who have the new ideas are fashionable. That is, it's fashionable to have them around, to patronize them. It's not really fashionable. Well, you can say that you sort of are interested in their ideas. Of course, none of these fashionistas who invite them into their homes would dream of putting any of their ideas into practice. It's just that by inviting them into their homes, they show how liberal-minded and open-minded they are. They do so, as we discover that Mrs. von Lemke and Mrs. Stavrogin, to use your translator's way of referring to them, think about them, is that, well, Mrs. Stavrogin wants to be up to date and with it, you might say, with the youth. Mrs. von Lemke thinks that she's going to convert them from their childish ways by bringing them into her, you might say, into her intimate association. Not too intimate, of course. So, they had spent the whole winter season in Petersburg. By Lent, however, everything burst like a rainbow-colored soap bubble. Their dreams vanished into thin air, and the confusion, far from being cleared up, became worse confounded. To begin with, the connections with the higher circles failed to materialize, except on a very microscopic scale, and at the cost of humiliating efforts. Deeply mortified, Mrs. Stavrogin at first showed a violent interest in the new ideas and began giving evening parties. She sent out invitations to literary people, and hundreds of them immediately turned up at her house. Afterwards, they came without being invited, and they brought their friends with them. Never in her life had she seen such literary men. They were incredibly vain, but made no secret of it, as though they were so on principle. And of course, who's the figure in the novel who sums up this terribly vain, on principle literary man?
Karamazov.
Yeah, Karamazinov, actually, is where the accent goes. Karamazinov, who is a caricature of Turgenev, with whom Dostoevsky had an on and off relationship that at its best was cordial in a distant way, and at its worst, well, produced this character. But you know, in a novel, I think you have no right to say, oh, well, this is Dostoevsky getting even with Turgenev. No, I think Karamazinov is really a kind of composite figure. He's meant to represent the literati of this time, and it's pretty much summed up in what the narrator here says. as though they were on principle. Some, though by no means all, turned up drunk, but they seemed to regard it as some new manifestation of grace they had discovered only the day before. They all appeared to be quite extraordinarily proud of something. On all faces was written that they had only just discovered some highly important secret. Now, throughout the novel, there is this matter of some highly important secret. There is something going on. Some people have no idea what it is. Others know what it is, but seek to avoid it. And others know what it is and keep it quiet on purpose. And we see, of course, that that stands behind the first climax that we get in the first third or so of the book, which is referred to by Verkhovensky as another man's sin, and that reaches its moment of fulfillment, though even there the secret isn't completely revealed when Nikolai Stavrogin gets slugged by whom? Shatov, right. See, I'm priming you for your test next time. All right. So they abused each other and were proud of it. It was not easy to find out exactly what they had written, but there were critics, novelists, dramatists, satirists, and exposers of abuses among them. And among them is Mr. Verkhovensky, who wormed his way into their highest circle from which the movement was directed. It was a stiff climb, but they welcomed him with open arms, though, of course, none of them knew or had heard anything about him except that he represented an idea. All right, so this means that he has, by the way, they came by the hundreds, all right, invited or not, but eventually they end up in the provinces, that is, in a provincial capital. And it is there then that this circle, much reduced in size, then begins to operate. Now, it's important to notice that the circle itself is the progenitor of everything that happens in the novel. Now, ultimately, all the radicalism, mild though it is in Verkhovensky's liberal direction, and rather vague, a vague liberalism at that, not very precisely defined. We're not altogether sure exactly what he stands for. Hence the Faust Part II parody, though not deliberately a parody. And he always has these delusions of persecution. And of course, you have to see that in this fashionista world of the intellectual, to be persecuted is to garner prestige. Without persecution, no prestige. So you have to present yourself as persecuted. On the other hand, you think about the tendency among Russians to see being victimized as part of being Russian. So again, Verkhovensky is a self-constructed parody of being a Russian. And yet, he's sympathetic. I don't think we really are meant to laugh at him. I think we empathize with him as a man that is, in fact, not persecuted in the way he thinks, because the real persecution comes from Madame Stavrogin, with whom he has been in love, although she is not beautiful, and she's on in years, she's in her 40s. She has a sort of horse-shaped face, we're told. And she is, like so many upper class women in Dostoevsky, an absolute tyrant. Women may not be liberated in Dostoevsky's society, but they certainly seem to call the shots, at least in The Idiot and in The Devils. There are the strong ladies then, like Madame von Lemke and like Madame Stavrogin, and who are really the string pullers and the rulers, the leaders of their societies. All right, so there are a number of things to note. For example, on page 83, we learn that Dasha, Shatov's sister, is not only brought into the Stavrogin household as a kind of charge of Madame Stavrogin, but also she is a pupil of Verkhovensky, who's also Nikolai's tutor, and he is also Lizaveta's teacher. So these three have all been taught by Stepan Verkhovensky. And we, again, this is important to note, because their relationship then, this triangular relationship among the three younger people, means that they too, in some respect, are disciples of Stepan Verkhovensky. All right, so.
Sorry, but I was a little confused by why Lisa on this page was called Lisa Tushin, because I thought her mother was.
Second marriage.
Oh, right.
Okay.
Thank you.
And she can marry Maurice because he is obviously a relative. We're never told exactly how he's related. He's obviously a relative of her second husband. And so there's no blood relationship between him and Lizaveta. Okay? Just to straighten that out. All right. We're told now that Verkhovensky wants to marry Madame Stavrogin. And what happens? We're told in their relationship twice. She says something. What does he do?
She says, "I'll never forgive you for this."
What is this?
The
first time.
The first time it's, he gets the arbor, the scene in the arbor, and offers, I don't remember if he exactly comes to offering her his hand. He's at least thinking it, imagining it.
Oh, she knows what he's trying to do. Why will she never forgive him?
Well, isn't he thinking really that she wants him to ask her to marry him?
Mm-hmm.
Not that, I mean, I think she is, that's a sort of a struggle with pride. Like, I would never bow down to you. I am in control of this. I mean, I don't know. That's what it seems like.
Yeah, it's presumptuous on his part.
Well, doesn't he have to kind of convince himself? Like, if, when he first decides this, he's not really sure what he wants to do about it, and then he eventually, you know, decides that that's what he wants to do. But
is he really in love with her? What do you think?
I would say a weird love.
Well, it's a platonic love,
isn't
it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a love that it's a love that probably wouldn't even need to be consummated for him to be happy with her. But what's embarrassing in this for Verkhovensky? I mean, let's grant that it's platonic. Although, you know, he could marry her and it could remain platonic.
She's his benefactor.
Yeah, his benefactress, yeah. I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
Oh, I was just going to say he's financially dependent on her.
Sure, yeah. And as long as that's the case, he's subordinate to her. Not that if he were her husband, he wouldn't be subordinate to her either. Look at the von Lemkes. As a matter of fact, and you remember very similar relationships in The Idiot, as a matter of fact. Who and who?
General.
The Yupanchins, same thing. The the general who is pretty much browbeaten by his wife. Well, poor Stavrogin. He suffers a complete fiasco in Petersburg, and he wants to gain respect for his, quote, exile, unquote, his exile. Instead, he gets exiled to the provinces, where he can continue to believe that he's been exiled, except that he is booed mercilessly on the platform, and he breaks into tears. Mrs. Stavrogin took him home, this is on 39, more dead than alive. On m'a traité comme un vieux bonnet de coton. They treated me like an old cotton bonnet. He babbled senselessly. She looked after him all night, gave him laurel and cherry drops, repeating to him till daybreak, "You're still useful. You'll still make a public appearance. You'll be appreciated in another place." So he goes to another place, to the Stavrogin country estate. And notice, by the way, in all of this, it's interesting to see how in part one, the narrator is very much a character in his own right. He tells us what he's heard from different people. He is escorted to different places. He meets Lebyadkin, for example, because he's escorted to his room by Shatov, and so on and so forth. And there he's very much a participant. In part two, now the mysteries of part one are cleared up in the course of part two, and there he sort of pulls back into a, not an omniscient narrator, but a narrator who seems much less of a participant in this case. And an interesting question to ask ourselves from the point of view of techniques of fiction is whether or not what he says in part two is to be taken altogether at face value. We assume that it is, as a matter of fact, because we have no reason to think that he's biased in any way. But we have to bear in mind that a lot of what we hear in part two about events, about what people did and said, about, say, what they were thinking, or how they appeared to act, all of that now is filtered through somebody else besides the narrator. And I think that's important technically, because it brings us closer to what is the real center of action here, which is not an individual's opinion, but public opinion. Everything is driven here by public opinion. Have you noticed how important all that is? And if you noticed how the radicals exploit it to the hilt, they use public opinion to their advantage, even while flaunting it, even while refusing to follow the guidelines that they're expected to follow. And all the while, since they are youthful rebels, they make themselves wealthy in the higher social circles as a result. There you have a paradox. They break the rules and they are admired for doing it by the very people who make the rules, but who don't make the rules. That's the whole point here. Dostoevsky is not just one of the first psychologists, he's probably the first social anthropologist as well, or one of the first anyway. I suppose the first social anthropologists were missionaries in the 18th century who described very unusual Pacific Island cultures and so on and so forth, and who had to learn their religions and mythologies and social practices in order to convert them. But be that as it may, Dostoevsky is very clear, I think, about this, especially in part two, about how everyone, in one way or another, is under the thumb of this impersonal set of rules that is imposed on all society, and which the radicals then use to their advantage by flouting it and flaunting it at the same time. So they flout convention, but not so much that they appear conventional. They dress up for these things in a coat and tie, as it were. And of course, as Dr. Cowan mentioned a couple of times ago, Dostoevsky was the one who said ideas have consequences. And this society, you see, that imagines that it takes action, that it consists of the people with power to act, they don't take ideas very seriously. Ideas are things you can discuss politely over cocktails. Ideas are something that, you know, you can entertain, but only in your imagination. The great fault of this society is that it doesn't know how to take ideas seriously. And yet, ideas are simply another feather in the cap of the fashionistas. So they can have advanced ideas, but those ideas are just ornamentation. They're jewelry, as it were. So, for his own self-esteem, it is important for Stepan Verhovensky to have some place where his ideas are given a hearing. It's interesting to look at the way in which these ideas then are brought into play, because you'll notice that there don't seem to be any two characters in his circle whose ideas conform to his. Maybe the narrator. We're never quite sure exactly where the narrator stands. He's a friend of Stepan Verhovensky, but he seems to, you know, poke gentle fun at him here in the opening. And though his sympathies for him seem to build as we read through to the end of the novel, remember this is all in retrospect. And so it's as though, as he tells about his friend, his respect for him grows a bit, but not before he has given us a thorough laundry list of his foibles. All right. I want to point out something really important here, though. You notice I'm skipping around a good bit, but you have to do that in Dostoevsky to tie up all these loose ends. You'll notice that his phrase, alia jacta est, which means what?
Die is cast.
Who said that?
Caesar.
What page is that?
346. When did he say it?
Crossing the Rubicon.
Where's the Rubicon?
Northern Italy.
Northern boundary, uh-huh. Into the Germanic territories, the barbarian territories. So we're Celtic Germanic, I suppose, to some extent. Why is that significant?
They broke up ties with the triumvirate.
Yes. And did what?
Pitted him against Pompey.
Yes, and expanded the Roman. Uh-huh.
I thought it was the other way around. I thought he was coming back to Rome and entering into the civilized turf.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
And there he was going to take over. So you're right. Okay. So after expanding the Roman Empire through conquest, he comes back and says, I am the conqueror, and he's going to make himself into, in effect, a monarch towards the end of the Roman Republic. Do you find Stepan Verhovensky's use of that famous phrase odd?
Yeah,
Alia Yakta est. What does he mean, the die is cast? What can that mean? Well, I mean, what does it mean to throw a die?
You leave your chances to fortune.
Uh-huh. And
there's no way to retract it. There's
yep.
No, there's only going forward, not going back.
Right. Is it pretentious? A bit? Oh, well, so that's how it's going to be. Except he doesn't speak in those terms. You know, it's done. It's over. I accept it. You know, it's over. Our relationship, it's gone. The die is cast. That's it. That's the last straw. So on. But will he go on as a conqueror? Seems less likely, doesn't it? Have you noticed that page 346 is almost exactly, in fact, I think I figured out that within a page or two, it is exactly the middle of the book. Just bear this in mind, right? The exact midpoint of the novel. Okay. Now, how do we deal with Verkhovensky? Well, one way of dealing with him is to see him as a sympathetic clown figure through a good part of the novel. When the die is cast, then we have to say, this is the moment, perhaps, when he stops being the intellectual fool and he becomes Caesar. But in what sense? And since we haven't read enough yet to see what that might mean, and we certainly haven't seen what happens at the fete that's coming up, I won't say anything more about it, but we'll hold that till next time. But on page 40, we begin to see these references to clowns. So we have references to America, the place where you escape to if you're a radical, or, as we'll see in the brothers, where you escape to if you're a criminal, or at least where you've been judged a criminal, whether you really are one or not. So it's the place where you can start over, start afresh. And of course, this part of America was something that was understood generally among Europeans, that it was a wild new place where radical social experiments were being tried out, A, and where you could go and lose your identity in a wilderness and start all over. And there is a well-known book written about this by R.W.B. Lewis, L-E-W-I-S, called The American Atom, in which he explores this theme throughout American literature. But backing up now a minute, there's America and then there's the clown figure, the fool or the clown. And it's interesting to see that the Verkhovenskys, father and son, are both clowns, but in very different senses. So you can have the demonic clown on the one hand, and you can have the carnival clown on the other. And they share certain characteristics that we'll get into in just a minute. Verkhovensky starts out on his new journey. I shall come to life there. This is in chapter 7. I shall come to life there, he kept repeating. There at last I shall set to work. So the provinces are his America. He's going to get a new start there, a new life, which will come to an end now in the midpoint of the novel. But already in his first letters from Berlin, he struck his usual note. My heart is broken, he wrote to Mrs. Stavrogin. I can't forget anything. Here in Berlin, everything reminds me of my past, my first innocent raptures and my first agonies. Where is she? Where are they both? Where are you, my two angels, of whom I was never worthy? Where is my son, my beloved son? And you remember, of course, that he's not worthy of his son, he thinks, because he hasn't kept up with him. You know, he's barely acknowledged his existence. He sent him off to live with a relative. And lastly, where am I, my own self, my former self, strong as steel and firm as a rock, when today some fellow like Andreev, a Greek Orthodox clown with a beard, peut briser mon existence en deux, can break my existence into two, crack my existence into two, etc., etc. A Greek Orthodox clown with a beard. Now, he's a local. And later on, we discover that actually Madame Stavrogin doesn't think that badly of him. He's a respectable fellow. He's all right. But he's not the kind of person that poor Verkhovensky thinks of as proper company for him. And at the end of that chapter, he says to the narrator, after he's hurried back to Skovrenishki, his last letters were entirely filled with the outpourings of the most, this is page 42, of the most sentimental love for his absent friend, and were literally bedewed with tears of separation. You can see the teardrops on the page. There are natures who, like lapdogs, become extremely attached to a home. The meeting of the two friends was rapturous. 2 days later, everything was as before and even more boring than before. My friend, Mr. Verkhovensky, said to me a fortnight later in Dead Secret, my friend, I've discovered something that is too awful for words. Je suis un ordinary hanger-on et rien de plus. Mais rien de plus. So I'm an ordinary hanger-on and nothing more. Mais nothing more. Right. Hysterical outbursted sobbings on my shoulders did not in the least interfere with our felicity. And so his nose turned slightly red and he grew more benign. A circle of friends began to gather around him, though never a large one. And so Mrs. Stavrogin, who stayed distant from the circle, was nevertheless regarded as its patron. All right, so we see the beginnings of the circle, and yet we wonder just how much Mr. Verkhovensky really influences the circle. They acknowledge him as a sort of éminence grise, you know, an honorary esteemed personage who is, you might say, sort of the occasion for the circle's meeting, but not necessarily the man who really dominates it particularly. And so Madame Stavrogin pays for the wine. And guess who provides the wine? The clown with the beard, Andreev, who is, by the way, of German descent, but he's become Greek Orthodox. The Germans come in for it hard in Russian fiction. The example that Nabokov gives, the most flagrant example he gives of Vorschlust, is of a German who plunges into the water naked and cavorts with swans in front of the balcony of his beloved, and she marries him right afterwards. You know, he puts his arms around the necks of the swans. Oh, terrible. So then in chapter 8, we get a kind of list with descriptions of the various disciples, so to speak, of Verkhovensky. And you might say that his circle then is climaxed, and his sentimentality. By the introduction of the young man that he calls Prince Harry. But before we look at that, we note that 3 years later, at the second paragraph there, people began talking of nationalism and public opinion came into being.
What page is this story?
It's page 50. Are my pages the same as your pages?
Yeah,
okay. Mr. Verkhovensky had a good laugh. My friends, he instructed us, if our nationalism has in truth been born, as they assure us now in the papers, it is still at school at some German Peterschule, sitting over a German book and repeating its everlasting German lesson. And the German master makes it go down on its knees whenever he likes. I've nothing but praise for the German teacher, but it's more likely that nothing has happened and nothing of the kind has been born, but everything is going on as before, that is, as God has ordered it. In my view, that should be quite enough for Russia. Pour notre sainte Russie, for our holy Russia. Besides, all these Slav movements and nationalities, all that's too old to be new. If you like, nationalism has never really existed in our country, except as in some idle invention by some gentleman at a club, a Moscow club at that. I'm not talking about the days of Prince Igor, of course. The whole thing, in fact, is the result of idleness. Everything is the result of the charming, cultured, whimsical idleness of our gentry. I've been repeating it for the last 30,000 years. We don't know how to live by our own labor. Now, he refers to the Peterschule. And I notice that this is not, well, this nothing is glossed here, I don't think. We don't have any notes, unfortunately. The Peterschule was a school in St. Petersburg, hence the name Peter's School, although in German, and the circle that Belinsky and others presided over in Petersburg, and into which Dostoevsky was welcomed after he circulated the manuscript of Poor Folk, was called, some of the group were called the Petrashevskys. That is, they were the young radicals who had come from this Peterschule, you see. Dostoevsky's point here is that like the Peterschule, out of which came first a kind of liberalism and nationalism on the part of Belinsky, who combined liberalism with this newfound nationalism, all of this came out of an environment that was, you might say, relatively benign. But why nationalism? Well, think about it. What two countries in the 19th century became nations for the first time?
Germany and Italy.
Germany and Italy. And Germany during Dostoevsky's early years with Bismarck, and Italy a little bit later, but not much later, in the 1860s. So, here are, think of Germany and Italy for a moment. Italy, with its venerable past, its magnificent past, a whole civilization, and yet not a nation. And then think of Germany, a collection of disparate, duchies and princedoms and portions, former portions of the Holy Roman Empire and this and that and the other, speaking different dialects of German and united only by traveling theater companies from the 16th century on. This Germany, dominated by Prussia, then is pulled together by a skillful statesman who knows how to play the nationalist card. And so Verkhovensky, from his perspective, sees exactly the same thing going on for Russia. But wait a minute, Russia has already become an empire under the Tsar, which is just Russian for Caesar, you know. I mean, it's literally Russian for Caesar, as Kaiser is German for Caesar. They're just transliterations. So there's this notion of empire. And then there's Peter the Great, who is clearly building a capital not on the ancient Russian model, but on the new Western nationalist model, which, beginning in the early 18th century and coming out of the discovery of the concept of a nation state in the 16th century, has already taken hold in the West. So this means that Verkhovensky is neither a radical like his son on the far left, nor a radical on the far right like the Slavophiles, who are emerging at about this time. You know what happens to people in the middle? They get insulted by being called moderates. You know what happens to moderates? They get hated by both sides and eventually drummed out of office because they are seen as wishy-washy or not able to make up their minds or having no principles of their own. So we can't feel too well about this. But he does have a few interesting things to say of 51. Russia is too big a problem for us to solve it alone, without the Germans and without work. For the last 20 years, I've been sounding the tocsin and calling to work. I've given my life to that appeal, and madman that I am, believed in it. Now, I no longer believe, but I go on ringing the bell and shall be ringing it to the very end of my last breath. I shall hold on to the bell rope till they start tolling it for my own requiem. Alas, we just nodded in agreement. Now, notice in the next paragraph, after he speaks of he says, we applauded our teacher, but don't we still hear today, and very often too sometimes, the same sort of charming, clever, liberal Russian nonsense. Our teacher believed in God. I don't understand, he used to say sometimes, where everybody here thinks I'm an atheist. I believe in God. Me distingo. That's distinguish here. Or let's make a distinction. I believe in him as a being who is conscious of himself in me only. Ah. Here we see that the besetting sin, there are two things going on here. In a sense, Verkhovensky has already laid the seeds for a Kirillov. We can see that. In other words, man is potentially God. There's something a little Hegelian about this. He has studied his German masters well. That is, it is man's destiny ultimately to become one with spirit. But take it a step further and says, well, if God exists only in me, if he becomes conscious of himself in me only. In other words, God can only be manifest in man. He can only come to awareness of himself in man, then God becomes the servant of man. Does he not? Is he really thinking of this? So he says, don't confuse me with Shatov. Shatov doesn't count, for Shatov believes in spite of himself, like a Moscow Slavophil. I'm not a Christian. I'm rather an ancient pagan, like the great Goethe, or like an ancient Greek. And now we understand, you see, the what's going on in his Faust Part II imitation. So anyhow, he says, I don't want to become a Jesuit. And he speaks of Belinsky, who reproached him for believing in some sort of God. And anyway, he goes on to talk about Gogol and Gogol's letters, which caused great dismay among Belinsky's circle and so on. Right, so we get all of this, and Shatov objects on page 52. Never did those men of yours love the people. They never suffered for them, and they never sacrificed anything for them, however much they imagined it for their own comfort. And so he goes on to speak of this business. He says, they didn't love the people. He's talking about Belinsky and the others. Oh, how they loved Russia. Neither Russia nor the people, Shatov cried with flashing eyes. You can't love something you don't know. And they had no idea of the Russian people. All of them, you among them, overlooked the Russian people. And so he goes on to say, he who has no people has no God. Now, Shatov is interesting, too, because he has learned his lesson from Verkhovensky all too well. Later on, he's asked, you remember, if he believes in God, when he's questioned by Stavrogin, and he says, well, I will believe in God. In other words, to carry out my convictions, I have to have God. Therefore, God is the result of my convictions. I have to believe him. Now we see throughout that what really dominates this society is vanity. The prevailing sin everywhere. Whether one is a radical or one is, say, a Madame Stavrogin or a Madame von Limke. Everything is determined by vanity and by a desire to be on top. So it's a kind of will for power, but it's a power that doesn't do much. It doesn't act. All it does is move to stasis. It simply reaffirms what is already there. It's a way, you might say, of keeping things on the same path without changing anything. Well, we learn in the chapter Prince Harry all about Verkhovensky's sentimental attachment to his young charge. Oh my goodness, they weep together. It's embarrassing to read. And we have to think that this strange world that Piotr has grown up in, Peter has grown up in, has something to do with his total lack of feelings later. He is a man with no real feelings. He's a man with no vanity either. He has no vanity because he has no feelings. No feelings for anyone else or for himself, except that he is, in some sense, a sort of lord of misrule in his own right. And we get that on page 58. In chapter, or is that I can get a little confused with this. It's section 2 of chapter 2. What does he do that's so terrible? He goes to a club and he pulls around the room by the nose.
So we're talking about Nicholas right now?
I'm sorry, I said Piotr. Yeah. I meant Nicholas. Yeah, slip of tongue. Thank you for pointing that out. Yeah. Yeah, we're talking about Nicholas. We could have been talking about Piotr, by the way, acts through sheer vanity, I think, but a different kind of vanity. I don't think I would call Nikolai as a man of vanity. There's something else going on there, very strange. Is the devil vain? Well, Milton's devil is vain. I'm not so sure, though, that a demon, yeah, that the Russian devil is. I think he is a lot more sinister than mere vanity can account for.
Mm-hmm. We're not supposed to take this as a literal devil, as in a fallen angel that has an entity of its own that gets inside people, are we?
Well?
Because I thought you had said earlier in all of Dostoevsky there has to be a rational explanation.
Well, I didn't say there has to be a rational explanation. I'd say there is always an alternative rational explanation, which means that you can either say these people are possessed, in fact, or you can say, if you want to, you can say there are certain unseen forces that seem to be let loose from time to time in history and that swarm about and cause terrible destruction and wreak havoc. They cause chaos and death and great suffering. And who knows what they are? Are they the result of some sort of collective spirit that roams about and takes hold? A sort of opposite side of the coin from the sort of social control that we're largely unconscious of when it operates on us? Is there the dark side, you might say, of what society does, the counterpart in the realm of the demonic, a daimon that is a power that roams about hungrily, seeking victims? You can do what you want with it. You can interpret the novel either way. But in any event, how do they interpret Nikolai's behavior? Oh, what else does he do? Uh-huh. And what else?
Kisses.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Liputin's wife. She's very pretty. So he just says, hey, she's pretty. I'll do what I want. Poor Liputin. What does the wife do?
Faints.
He kisses her not once, but three times passionately. And then finally, he bites the governor's ear. He pretends to whisper in his ear, and then somebody bites it.
I'll tell you why.
Yeah, I'll tell you why. And people are just, as anybody would be. I mean, you'd have to say, what the? And how do they explain this behavior?
Brain fever.
Yes. See? Do they say he's possessed by a demon?
No.
No, it's brain fever.
Jamming's a lot at Dostoevsky.
Yes, it does. Brain fever is a very popular explanation. And by the way, if you've got a slight headache, it's the flu. Anything will work as an explanation. Some are better than others. So. All right, by the way, on page 71, Verkhovensky is accused of being a corrupter of youth, and we know where that comes from. But I think we'd say, and he says, I am not, you know, I don't even deserve to be called that. We'd say, you mean Socrates? No, you don't deserve to be called Socrates. Page 73 is a description of Karamazov. It's pretty funny. But on page 72, we have you have Mrs. Stavrogin referring to, at the top of the page, that fool Mrs. Drozdov herself, she was always a fool, suddenly glared at me as though wondering what I came for, and so on. And then, oh, you're a Bismarck. I am no Bismarck, but I am capable of seeing through hypocrisy and stupidity when I meet them. Mrs. Lemke is hypocrisy and Praskovya stupidity. I don't think I've ever met such a flabby woman in my life, and her legs are swollen, and she's good-natured. What could be more foolish than a good-natured fool? Oops. Who else is a good-natured fool? An ill-natured fool, my bon ami, my good lady friend. An ill-natured fool is still more foolish, Mr. Verkhovensky retorted nobly. I dare say you're right. It's coming pretty close to home there. What does Madame Stavrogin admire about Lisa? Well, she says, what she likes about her is that she stands up to her mother. And yet, she goes on to speak of, at the top of page 73, she was trying to get into speaking of the two women before. It says, she was trying to get into the good books of Count K through Nicholas. She was out to set a son against his mother. But then she finds it perfectly acceptable for Lizaveta to stand up to her mother. So we can see that, there is a great deal of just plain, what can we call it, double standard going on here. And, oh my goodness, there's so many things. On page 76, for example, in the middle of the page, there, why is she so angry with me? He kept complaining every minute like a child. Tous les hommes de génie de progrès en Russie étaient, sont et seront toujours des drunkards et des gamblers. Qui boivent like fish. All of the men of genius and progress in Russia were, are, and will be always drunkards and gamblers who drink like fish. And I'm not such a drunkard and gambler as all that. And so, and she tells him, he said, I bet you're not walking 5 miles a day like your doctor ordered. Just for that, you'll walk 8. So what we get in, notice what we get here. In the carnivalesque routine, you might call it, the carnivalesque ritual, then, a fool is taken, a fool, a lowly person, a clownish fellow, and he is made king for the day, the king of carnival. And he becomes the lord of misrule. Anything he says goes. All rules are broken. Now, carnival, as Bakhtin tells of it, then evolved. We'll talk about this next time. Carnival evolved from the Middle Ages through a number of stages until finally it became an official sort of thing that was countenanced or at least tolerated by both church and state. But in the course of carnival, the Lord of Misrule, then the clown is elevated to become the supreme ruler for a day. But at the end of his rule, then he is beaten and brought back to his former level and run away, run out of town. There's a kind of scapegoat ritual that goes on in Carnival. Now, it has not missed, it has not been, you might say, lost on anthropologists and others that the crucifixion also seems to play out a scapegoat ritual in which a goat or a lamb is selected. The people lay their hands on the goat and transfer all their faults and sins to the scapegoat, and then the scapegoat is run out of town and carries off with him all of those sins. And now the people can be at ease because they are relieved of their guilt for the bad things they've done. In Carnival, it seems, we have a somewhat attenuated version of this, in which there is a critique of the powers that be on the one hand, and on the other, there is, you might say, a moment of free license that allows people to get what has been bothering them. They're feeling oppressed by social rules or by the state or by the church. They get it all out of their system in one day, and then they go back to living under exactly the same rules and social strictures that they lived under during the whole year. And you can see this going on in the novel, except now it's been demonized. Something terrible has happened. And the real demons in the novel are these characters who are, on the one hand, could be good people, but who have somehow, through a peculiar kind of vanity, gotten into their hands that they have to act according to their own wills, or they're no one. And they will do this, ultimately, if you go all the way with Piotr Verhovensky, what he says is, we have to now kill a lot of people, and we have to subjugate 90% of all the people, and 10%, the people who are really intelligent and powerful and understand, will rule over them. And boy, if you look at him, you say, oh, this is chillingly prescient. This is a Bolshevik before his time. But more of that on Thursday.
We have quizzes ready for Father's